Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Bye. I'm very excited to introduce Joyce Friend Pinson, who is a farm-to-table advocate. She has a background in agriculture, media, and small business. Joyce shares real-life stories about heirloom gardening, cooking, and food preservation. She's a baby boomer living in Appalachia, Kentucky. She's a local television host, writes a regional column, and blogs on her website, Friends Drift In. Full of fun, giggles, and valuable information, I'd like to welcome to our show the entertaining Joyce Pinson. So welcome to the show today, Joyce.
Thank you, Jackie. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm just very excited. I loved looking at your little videos on your website this morning and just learning lots of different things. So go ahead and tell the audience a little bit more about yourself.
Well, I'm 55 years old. I grew up in rural Kentucky in a community that was focused on family gardens, beef cattle, and dairy production. I'm an only child. I was active in 4-H. I attended the University of Kentucky in Ag Economics back in the 1980s. That was when sustainable and organic farming practices were considered pretty much a folly by most of the academic community. I did with extension, and then I moved to the private sector, and I did sales and marketing. When I turned 50, I went through more than one change. I had enough of corporate and business world, and I wanted to be out on the farm. I wanted to be out in the fresh air. So I started Friends Drift In Enterprises, and that incorporates what I call my encore career. And that led me to being a farmer and a food writer, a media personality, and of course I advocate for Appalachian ag and food waste. I've been married to my husband over 32 years, and we live in a big red barn. We're in the eastern Kentucky coal fields, as far east as you can go in Kentucky and still not be in West Virginia. Oh. In addition to our insurance business, we farm about 10 acres. It's on family farm that's been in the family for about six generations.
Oh, wow.
We focus on heritage breed poultry. We do heirloom fruits and vegetables from around the world. And we're open our farm up from time to time to individuals and small school groups so they can see for themselves what farming in Appalachia can be profitable and how it can be done.
Nice.
So that's pretty much where I am right now.
Well, that's a lot right there. And I'm sure our listeners are going to pick up on the profitable part. So that's good to hear, too. You know, from a farming perspective. So, let's go ahead and dig in a little further. So I always like to kind of start the show by asking my guests to tell us about like your very first gardening experience. You know, how old were you? Were you a kid, an adult? What'd you grow? Who were you with?
I was probably about 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. And I can remember, my mom was a gardener and all my family gardened. And they gave me a little 10 by 10 spot, and I don't know whether it was Burpees or Gurney's, but one of the major seed companies at that time was selling little pails that had all these packets of seeds in them. And I grew this plot, and it was kind of a hodgepodge, but it really inspired me and the imagination of a 4-year-old, 5-year-old. And I got hooked from there. And, of course, my grandfather, he was one to save heirloom seeds. But he was always eager to do the unusual variety, something new and different or something that was from someplace far away from Kentucky.
Oh.
And he used those vegetables within his restaurant, which was Friends Drift In, which is how I came by the name Friends Drift In. But I think I got my seed addiction at an early age from my grandpa friend.
So that is your maiden name?
Sure.
I wondered about that.
Cool.
It's a double
meaning, you know, Friends Drift In, you know, come on in and visit with me, sit on the porch and have some sweet tea. But it's also my maiden name. Aww. So it's kind of a fun thing.
Nice. And just so listeners know, in has two N's, like an inn or,
correct,
you know, a place, right, that you would go and stay. So it's Friends,
yes,
Drift In,
uh-huh,
is the website. Okay, well then, do you want to just share with us really quick, like, what is organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening mean to you?
Well, for me, one of the key motivators in market gardening is to preserve diversity through growing heirloom vegetables and educating people about what makes that variety special. So while I'm not a certified organic gardening, for me, the growing experience is about improving the soil and keeping a bee-friendly environment, which avoids pesticides.
Oh, I like that. A bee-friendly environment that avoids pesticides. Excellent. So then who or what inspired you to start using techniques? Was it your grandfather or
someone
else?
Oh, it was definitely my mama. My mama was kind of what I would call a granola back in the 60s. You know, she subscribed to Organic Gardening magazine, you know, and she wore the hippie clothes. And, you know, she was the type, you know, daddy asked her one time, what do you want for your anniversary? And my father was a mechanical engineer, and we had a comfortable middle-class life. But mom didn't ask for jewelry or a car or a new dress. She wanted a giant pile of compost and a big batch of strawberries to plant. And so, you know, that's kind of, you know, that's how I grew up. That's what inspires me. And even at age 77, my mom continues to inspire me in the garden and how to preserve the Appalachian soil.
Aw, I love that. I was, you know, I think just yesterday I was telling somebody my favorite anniversary present from Mike was on our 14th anniversary, and I have been bugging him and bugging him for a compost pile outside of the kitchen, not down by the garden, because our garden's like down this tiny little hill on the other side away from the door, which, you know, so this way it's right out the door and I can just, you know, while I'm cooking, go throw stuff right in it, and it just makes it convenient. You can, you know, stir it anytime you just happen to be going by because you're walking in and out that door. And oh, that's sweet. I love that. And I'm a granola 100%. I was born in 1967 in the middle of the summer of love. You know,
there you
couldn't
go.
Be more of a, I was like, my mom missed the whole thing, but I guess I was there. So, all right, well, go ahead and share with us then, how did you learn how to garden organically? From your mom, pretty much then?
Pretty much from my mom. My mom was very much into the organic thing. My grandfather, in addition to the Friends Drift Inn restaurant, we had a roadside garden stand. We had a orchard and bees and a garden. So we would do the market garden. What wasn't sold at the roadside stand was incorporated to the menu at Friends Drift Inn. We were doing farm to table long before anybody even had coined the phrase. So, you know, my grandpa and my mom, you know, two of my biggest influences, definitely.
Excellent. I just love that. And I love the way there's the restaurant part there. So, all right, well then let's talk about your garden this last season. So tell us about something that grew well, like last summer, this, you know, your most recent crop.
Our best crop, our most profitable crop, is cowhorn okra. That's not something that is associated with Appalachia, but it grows like mad here. We can pick it every other day and never keep up. It's a really popular item at our farmer's market. And, you know, once you have fried fresh okra, or once you have pickled fresh okra, the hard old pods that you find in the box stores just don't measure up. So for me, it's all about the okra.
Nice. I just had somebody I was interviewing yesterday that's going to be on, I think, on Thursday sometime talking about okra. Or somebody I just talked to very recently was talking about that was their favorite recipe. All right, cool. So, and it should, now, what makes it your most profitable crop? Can I just ask, in case listeners are curious about that?
Well, when you, I won't even tell you how much I'm getting a bushel. But, I mean, when you break it down, because we sell them in little produce crates, like what you would sell strawberries in, just a small little quart crate, you know, and I'm able to sell those here for $5 or $6 a crate, that adds up real fast. And, I mean, you know, I think the trick, if you're a marketer, is when you put them in the little crates that you know, you turn all the ends up so it looks real pretty, like little soldiers up in a line. But, you know, it's a very profitable crop. Now, it's labor-intensive in that, you know, you have to pick very frequently. But, man, you know, that's my moneymaker.
Cool. And do you sell it to stores or just to people?
Right now I'm just selling it at our local farmer's market. We have a farmer's market on Tuesdays and Saturdays, and you would be surprised what sells well in Kentucky Appalachia.
Okay.
You would be very surprised.
All right. Well, maybe, no, you were saying that's not normally a crop that grows in Kentucky, so maybe that's why it sells so well, because you have it there and other people don't.
In Kentucky, it does grow, but in Appalachia, it's definitely not something that's part of our foodways. So, but people love it. I mean, you know, once they figure it out, they love it. And that's part of the mission of Friends Drift In, is educating people on different foods and different produce and trying something different. I mean, it's exciting.
Excellent. So then how about something you're excited to try different next year, or something that you want to try new? Is there something different you're going to try?
Well, this year we made so many changes that it's hard for me to say. We've done a massive planting of winter squash and pumpkins. We're experimenting with sunflowers and zinnias. We're transitioning to a French biointensive method where we're using raised beds, and that's a new process for us. So I don't know how that's all going to work. Our growing season is from late May to mid-October here in 6D, which is our USDA zone. I've got experience using low tunnels, which is a very cost-effective way to extend the season. But I think if I were going to tell you one thing that I have to do new or different next year, it's bite the bullet and put in some high tunnels so we can be ready for market earlier and prolong the season in the fall.
Now, what's the difference between a low tunnel and a high tunnel?
A low tunnel is a really simple. It's basically we use two metal poles, and we put some PVC pipe across them to hoop them. There it stands about, the bed is about 5 to 6 foot wide. You put the hoop over it, and then you put Agribond over the top, which is like a frost protective blanket. It's kind of a non-woven material that looks a lot like Pellon if you sew. And so what you're doing with those low tunnels is you can do greens all year long. You could do cabbage and coal crops and greens, harvesting them up when there's snow on the ground. You literally just peel back the fabric, or if it's really cold, you've added a layer of plastic on top of the fabric, but you literally peel back the fabric and pick. And so low tunnels, I mean, you know, you can do a low tunnel, a 10-foot low tunnel that's 5 foot wide for probably less than $75. And so, I mean, that's a really economical way for growers. You know, they could do a larger amount, but even for home people, you know, growing greens at home in the wintertime, but the money that you would save, and with a really low investment, where a high tunnel is something that you can walk in, you know, it's probably got a 10-foot ceiling, and it's a lot bigger. Usually they're 10-foot wide, maybe 100-foot long, and you know, an investment of that would be $3,000 or $4,000 versus $150, or, you know, quite a bit different. And you know, just depending on how much you need to produce. But low tunnels are the way of the future for Appalachia, no doubt.
Okay, cool. Mike's been bugging me to get some of that Agribond stuff for him, some row covers or something.
Right.
So, cool. Tell us about something that didn't work so well this season. Was there something that didn't come out the way you wanted it to? You were expecting?
Oh, you have no idea, Jackie. I mean, it's been the craziest year in that we went from literally having frost cover on the kohlrabi and the coal crops to 90 degrees within a week. So my kohlrabi bit the dust. My pak choi and some of my other Asian greens got ate up by flea beetles because, I mean, I had them out. I did really well, but the weather just was so extreme. It just, you know, from freezing temperatures to 90 degrees within a week does not help a plant very much.
No. Aww. So that might be kind of why you're inspired to go ahead and put some high tunnels in, huh?
You know it.
Yep. Okay. How about something that you find is easy to grow and generally successful every time? Would that be the okra, or is there something else?
No, ma'am. I love heirloom beans. I'm all about beans and cowpeas. Beans really sell well at our market, and they're kind of something that is identified with the Appalachian dinner table. I also like to preserve beans, can them. So when the snow flies and I open that mason jar up, or I end up soaking some what we call a dried bean. It is a leather breeches, which is something you put on a string, leave in the pod, let them dry, and then you rehydrate them and cook them. But when I cook those beans, you know, I'm tasting summer in Appalachia even when the snow flies. Mm-hmm. So for me, beans is the bomb.
Now, what are cowpeas?
Cowpeas, I despise California black-eyed peas. But a black-eyed pea is a cowpea of sorts. Here in Appalachia, we grow, there's a variety of them. I grow a red cowpea that's a real long, probably produces like a 2-foot pod. I also grow some that are black and white called a Holstein. There's pink-eyed purple hulls and red rippers. And you can do them as shelly, like a shell bean, like you would cook a shell bean, or you can pickle them, or you can literally, I mean, shell them out like you do peas, which takes a lot of time, and then just barely cook them on the stove in a sauce pot, cooking them down with some water and a few herbs, and they are wonderful.
Ooh, that sounds good. So that's interesting. And, you know, nobody's really talked about growing any kind of beans like that on the show. Just mostly like green beans.
All kinds of beans. I mean, you know, we have what we call a greasy bean here in Appalachia. And what it is, instead of being, if you hold a bean in your hand, a regular green bean, you know, it's kind of got that fuzz on it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a greasy bean, it'll take a little longer to grow. It'll be about 70 days to come to maturity. But a greasy bean has got a slick pod, and it is one of the best-eaten beans ever. And, I mean, you know, around here, if you're growing greasy beans, well, you're welcome at anybody's home if you're going to bring greasy beans to the potluck. I mean, they are just the best. And, I mean, greasy kind of sounds weird, but it's greasy because that's the way the pod feels. It's slick instead of hairy.
Okay, I was going to ask you, is that like greasy, like G-R-E-A-S-Y, just like grease at the car place or whatever?
Ma'am. Yes,
okay.
Ma'am, but it's greasy because of the slickness of the pod, not because of the taste or the flavor.
That's probably kind of nice, though. That sounds good. Kind of like more like a pea, almost.
Uh-huh, yes. Uh-huh. I mean, yeah, a little bit like that, but it's got much, much richer and beanier, meatier flavor.
Nice. All right. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Now, Jackie, I just gonna tell you, there is nothing that I wouldn't try if I didn't have a little bit of planning and foresight. I mean, I've grown hot peppers, started them in January. You know, they may have 120, 130-day maturity date, which was really pushing it for my zone here in 6B. But if you get them started under the lights, you know, you can have a huge harvest. So I've seen farmers here in Appalachia grow kiwis. I've seen them grow Asian greens, exotic melons, mushrooms, lychee tomatoes, and they all crow about it. So from my perspective in Appalachia, anything is possible if you set your mind to it.
All right. I like that. Well, then what about colder weather? I guess, well, no, you sound like you have some pretty cold temperatures, too.
So. Oh, yes, ma'am.
You don't have a problem with, like, broccoli or, you know, the colder.
I do them in low tunnels, mm-hmm. And I've had good success with that. I mean, I haven't grown them more of a market yet. I'm working on that, but for my own use and for my mom and some of our family, you know, we grow broccoli in low tunnels and do very well.
All right. So what's your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there anything you have to force yourself to get out there and do?
Oh, you know it. In Kentucky, we get a lot of pop-up summer showers. And there is nothing worse in this world than having to go out and put on a long-sleeve shirt and try to pick okra with all of those leaves. You're like you're in the tropical rainforest and you can't breathe in the heat and the humidity. I hate picking okra in the rain. I cannot be more adamant.
That's excellent. Do you have to? So then you can't wait till it like dries off?
Well, not if you're a market gardener. You got to get it to market. You got to get it. And with okra, I mean, you want to pick okra when it's about the size of your pinky finger. I mean, to really get the best quality produce. And if you wait a day, it's going to be as big as your hand. And if you wait 2 days, it's going to be 2 foot long.
Oh,
So, I mean, you got to pick it when you pick it. I mean, you got to pick it every other day. And, I mean, a lot of people pick it every day.
Oh, all right. That's good to know. So then what is your favorite activity to do in the garden, Joyce?
I like to plant and I like to nurture them. There is nothing better than seeing a new plant pop out of the dirt.
Got anything popping out right now?
We've got beans, we've got corn, we've got summer squash. I've got lettuce beds are already up and going, and the basil is up and going. I've got cabbage probably be ready in about 2 weeks. Broccoli is ready in 2 weeks. So, yeah, we've got a lot going on.
Of
course, we've got grape. You know, we planted grapes and blueberries this year. Of course, I did do that from seed, but they seem to be doing very well too. So I'm excited. Always exciting.
Well, you're way ahead of us. We just have like radish seeds and spinach just barely popping out. Few tiny little carrots. My sunflowers are popping out though that I planted. Mike and I were debating and I was like, it's been 3 weeks.
Wow.
So they're just barely, they got like two little leaves. It's just all sprouting up.
I've got some volunteer sunflowers about 6 inches tall, but the ones I've put out haven't popped through yet.
All right. Tell us about the best crop you ever grew. Was there one year that something was just like so prolific you just were shocked and had so much you couldn't give it all away and didn't know what to do with it all?
My husband, Charlie, will disagree with me on this one, but I never get tired of seeing Kershaw's dot in the field. Kershaw is a signature winter squash here in Appalachia. And I preached to all my clients, the squash is very bulbous, it's big, it probably goes about 20 pounds. It's very big bulb on the bottom and it has a grip neck and it has its white body with green pinstripes on it. It almost looks like an angry goose. But anyway, a Kershaw, you know, I preached to all my clients. I say, you know, down here they want to just put them out with their fodder shock and use them for a lawn ornament. And I have a big sign at the farmer's market and it points to the Kershaws and it says, this is not a lawn ornament. Kershaw mix is a legitimate delicacy. It makes the best pumpkin pie you ever put your lips around. I make a fall cream brulee with it. I've done ice cream. I make bread with it. Kershaw is where it's at. That is my absolute favorite crop to grow and my favorite crop to see in the field, and it never fails to produce. It's very resistant to squash bugs. It just goes. It don't matter whether it's hot. It don't matter whether there's a drought on. Kershaw will come through for me every time.
Now, is that like a special seed that you have to get? Did I hear you talking about that on one of the videos, that was like a special seed that you had to find?
That is what inspired me to do what I do, because at one point in time, Kershaws was very common. I mean, everybody grew Kershaws. In the friend family, if you didn't put Kershaws in the garden, you did not have a garden. Oh. I mean, it just wasn't done. And there was like a 7-year span where I had to take care of a lot of a family and did not have time to even put out a small garden. Mm-hmm. And in that 7-year span, all the big commercial seed houses quit carrying a lot of the heirloom vegetables, and Kershaw was one that was dropped. And so I had to, contact, we have one of my heroes is Bill Best, who is a seed guru in Berea, Kentucky, runs Sustainable Mountain Agriculture. And I contacted him, and we ended up getting some Kershaw seed. And now I've got some commercial sources because, people are coming back around to appreciating heirlooms. But I was in a panic when I could not find Kershaw seed. So that's a big deal for me.
Now, just quickly, will you spell Kershaw for the audience in case they...
Sure. Kushaw. Kushaw.
Okay, cool. All right, I'm going to have to try that because those look good. And I like the way it's nice and big. Like you said, it's like a pumpkin.
Yes,
I have
ma'am.
A recipe from the Moosewood Cookbook for, is it Chilean squash, I think it's
yes,
called.
Yes, ma'am. I know the recipe. I love
it. And wouldn't that be?
Yes, ma'am. Uh-huh. Yes, ma'am.
Now, I make that a lot with pumpkin instead of with squash. But that might be a good squash to try.
Kushaw has got a little bit, you know, depending on the variety. I do a green striped Kushaw, and I get it from Southern Exposure Seed Exchange. But they, it's got a woodsy, smoky background, and that's what makes it really unique in its flavor profile. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'm still going to give it a try. Okay, how about, what's the best gardening advice you have ever received?
Oh, there's two things that I've been told, and one I think applies to every gardener no matter where you are.
Okay.
Start small. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a learning curve. If you plant too much and you don't know how much time and work it's going to involve, you're going to be frustrated. You know, you're going to wear yourself out until you kind of get a handle for it. Give yourself time to build up to a larger garden or a larger market garden, you know, depending on whether you're producing for your family or for sale. The hardest piece of advice for me to swallow is to be patient. Plants grow on Mother Nature's time, not mine, and that's frustrating.
And I think a lot of us here in Montana especially are going through, we want to put everything out. And one of my guests talked about that, like, you know, you're going to want to put it out early, but just wait. And like, we had such an early spring, like the end of February was like April. I mean, it was just crazy. Like,
wow,
the snow
even
melted.
In Montana, because I mean, I think of Montana as, snow covered.
It was just bizarre. The snow, like, melted practically overnight. The roads thawed. We had spring break up just incredibly early. And just everything was like, seemed like it was almost ready to plant. You're like looking at the temperature and thinking, you know, we've already had 70 degree days. And it's just been a crazy year. But then, of course, like last week, I think it was, we had some of those drop down to 22, I think. We were down to, or certainly 26 or 27 degrees a couple of mornings, and just, you know, that regular cold. And, you know, we really, our last frost isn't till probably June here. You know, it's not really safe to put stuff out till the, you know, end of May. And then, yeah, so we have a very short little window there. But so this year, be patient is definitely, because people have been wanting to get out there.
Get that itch.
So that's great advice. Here's a question that I kind of, I don't know, we might get rid of, but have you ever entered a fair?
I grew up in a community where harvest was celebrated at the county fair and the state fair. Now I'm in the heart of the Eastern Kentucky coal fields, Kentucky Appalachia, and that's just part of the cultural fabric here. There are no county fairs, and I miss that. But back when I was in 4-H, I grew lots of agriculture-type products. So, you know, I entered on potatoes, zinnias, tomatoes, peppers, corn. And, of course, I did a lot of prepared foods and preserved foods. And I love a competition, and I love a fair. And I think that when we compete, we learn because we're elevating our craft and we're reaching out for excellence. So for me, I love a fair. And
wow.
I hope that, you know, it's something that's one of my goals is to have a regional, reintroduce a regional agriculture fair here in Eastern Kentucky.
Well, I've never heard of anybody say that about competition. I've always kind of been like, I'm not very competitive, which I've found, especially in teaching, that there are definitely things that I'm a little more competitive than I probably should be. But I like that it's reaching out for excellence. It's not, it's almost like competing with yourself then that way, and just trying to do better and be the best that you can be, instead of like I'm going to beat you and
no,
maybe
it's just my mentality, but I mean, for me, a competition, I've learned from my competitors. You know, if I didn't do something right and they did something better, well, then next year I'm going to be better. You know, we lift each other up that way. All right, you know, that's the way I look at it.
Oh, I think that's precious. That's the best way anybody's ever described competition. And it really brings in the spirit of, you know, kind of, I don't know if you'd call it teamwork, but just working together and everybody benefiting. And I really like that, learning from each other. You're just full of great little tidbits and advice and just gardening, all kinds of gems. All right. How about a favorite tool that you like to use? If you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
You're going to laugh at me. we just bought a hoe, and every time you buy a farm implement, it seems like it's just, it's costing you an arm and a leg. And usually I go to some place like Tractor Supply and buy a hoe. And you work yourself silly. And we spent, $125 for this hoe. But let me tell you, when I go out in the garden and I just barely tap the soil and I can scrape those weeds and I'm not disturbing the soil, so the weeds are not going to come back as quick, it is the best $125 I've ever spent in my life. You can't have my hoe.
All right, but I might ask you to send me the link for that, because I'm just dying to know what kind of hoe you paid $125 for. That's doing. Is it like a special kind of hoe or what?
It's steel forged, and it's got us. Charlie could tell you more about it than I can. But we went to the Kentucky Fruit and Vegetable Conference, and there was a vendor there that had them, and I thought Charlie had lost his mind, and the vendor saying, "Oh, well, you just use this hoe like you do to sweep." And I was just like, usually when I use a hoe, I'm chopping, I'm whacking weeds and I'm taking the hoe above my head. I'm only 5'2", so I have to get a little momentum. With this new hoe, you really almost just sweep the weeds away. I mean, it's so much easier.
All right. I like that. Easier is better. So anything we can do to make gardening more convenient, more effective, more efficient, and easier, I think is just going to encourage more people to garden. And that's, my whole goal with
the podcast. One.
Yep. All right. So this question, eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time, my friend Lisa just chewed me out. She's like, that's not even a real question. You need a full sentence there. But I ask it because my big problem is always, I'm always busy and I go down to grab a basket of lettuce. And the next thing I know, I've got these two huge piles of lettuce or something. And then how do I get them? If I wash it all at once, they get soggy. If I, and a lot of times I'll pick it, I'll barely, make me a salad and then it sits. And then before I know it, it's bad. So any suggestions for that?
Well, I think with harvest, you learn by experience. You need to engage all your senses. You touch it, you smell it, you look at it. Does it look like it is, ready to eat? You taste it, and sometimes with fruit, you leave it on the vine a couple more days, it gets a little bit higher sugar content. You can tell. And then, of course, you even have to listen to your vegetables. Think about thumping a watermelon. How does it sound? There is a certain little thud when you thump a ripe watermelon. And so I think that it's just a skill that you learn by experience. And if you've got a mentor that, has done this before, that's one of the best ways to learn. And when you talked about spinning lettuce and, picking all your lettuce at once, if I'm doing it for myself, and not what I do for market, but if I'm doing it for myself, I don't spin it and wash it until I'm ready for it. I may pick a bunch of it and I'll put it in the refrigerator, but I don't spin it out and wash it until I'm ready to eat it, because I think it loses something once you spin it and wash it. You want to eat it right away then.
Okay. I like that. Do you use a salad spinner?
Yes, ma'am. Now, when we're doing market, there's no way that, I've got a 5 gallon spinner. And, I couldn't do, because we do a lot of kale and lettuces and Asian greens, and all of that has to be spun, and I could not possibly get enough for market if I had to do it any other way.
Really? Oh, I never thought of that. So like a commercial spinner. Did you make that yourself?
I got it on Amazon. It's a 5 gallon spinner, and it's red. I don't know what company it is.
Hmm.
It's red.
I'm going to look that up. Maybe that's what I need, is a bigger spinner. It's red. All right, cool. That might help. All right, how about secrets for preserving food, making it last? I know you do a lot of preserving and canning, right?
Yes, ma'am. For what I put up with my family, I usually can. That's what I do most of. But for me, it's all about using it all. For instance, I've got a spiral apple peeler, you know, that you kind of with the crank and it takes the peel off and then it cuts the apples into slices. So I can the slices for my apple pies and whatever I'm going to do for desserts and that type thing. But I keep the peels. And I accumulate them. I put them in a big plastic bag, and I accumulate them and accumulate them and accumulate them until I've got enough that I can throw them all in a pot and cook them down. And that's what I make my apple butter out of. So it's all about using the whole vegetable. In the food community, they talk about respecting the animal and you eating from snout to tail. You know, and I think the same thing applies to vegetables. A crazy idea I learned from celebrity chefs Brian and Michael Vitaggio is to dehydrate carrot tops. And when you dehydrate them, then you add a little seasoned salt to them, and you use that greens with the seasoned salt as a little finish on the top of your carrots that you've roasted in olive oil. And, I mean, it's wonderful, and it really makes things pop. So I think it's all about using the entire vegetable. We throw away too much of what could be eaten. You know, beet tops, you can cook them down, you know. So it's all about using all the vegetable and having a little imagination and play in the kitchen.
Nice. Wait, did you say the spiral apple peeler cuts the apples into slices, too?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Okay. No, would do that. Okay. How about special techniques for cooking any kind of weird or unusual foods? Anything?
I'm in a very unique situation in that I'm a food writer as well as a farmer. So I'm blessed to have a lot of chefs as friends. Jeremy Ashby in Lexington at Azure lets me play in his restaurant. And the chefs let me play a lot. So I'm blessed in that. And probably some of the weirdest things is Ed Lee was a former Top Chef competitor on TV, and he's a Kentucky chef from Louisville. His restaurant's 610 Magnolia. He's got me hooked on pickling rhubarb.
Oh, let's hear about that.
It's awesome. It's just real, you know, rhubarb is very tight or tart. You know, and it stays crisp when it's pickled, and it's an awesome accompaniment to what they call charcuterie, with, you know, a cheese plate, a meat plate, and it's pretty because, you know, most rhubarb, like the Victoria rhubarb, is very red, and so you just, it's really unusual, and it's addicting for me. Now, Appalachia is known for pickling, and I mean, we'll pickle anything, but rhubarb was not something I ever considered. And then Nathan Breeding is a chef over in, across the mountain here in Virginia, and he inspired me to pickle blackberries. And again, when a pickled blackberry mix, just the most fun garnish to, like, again, prepared meats like salami or a cheese plate. It just gives a little sparkle and something unexpected. I love unusual pickled items, and I thank my chefs for giving me the vision to see that, because it's not something I would ever come up with.
That's perfect. And Mike's always on me about making like a strawberry rhubarb pie or something, but I'll bet he might try that because he's really good at pickling things besides. And one giant rhubarb plant that I just can't ever seem to use all of. So cool.
You'll like it.
I don't think we'll ever have enough blackberries to pickle blackberries, but rhubarb, that sounds so good. And, I'm just thinking, you know, the shape of it and the texture and everything. I think that's going to mm-hmm. be a real treat. Excellent. All right. How about your favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden? Is that squash, or is there something else? Or what's your favorite recipe from the garden?
In the summer, I don't like to heat up the kitchen very much. And one of the mm-hmm. things that I really love is Swiss chard. And we just do Swiss chard with, pick it, wash it. Lightly wilt it in a cast iron skillet with a little olive oil, and just get it barely wilted, grate a little bit of fresh nutmeg over it, put a sprinkling of pepper flakes on it, and maybe serve it with a boiled egg. Now that is it. You know, mm-hmm. that is a quick dinner, that's a quick lunch, and especially if you're coming out of the fields, you know, you're not putting a lot of work into it, you're not you know, we get really hot temperatures here in Kentucky, and I mean, you're not heating up the kitchen, and it's very satisfying and beautiful on the plate.
I like that. I love Swiss chard. Cool. All right. How about a favorite internet resource?
I have to say she's my friend, but and one of my good friends, but probably someone that I admire the most that has really gone above and beyond what a blog should be is Kathy Raymer. Her blog is called Mother of a Hubbard. It's won numerous awards. Best writing for a blog is one. I think Better Homes and Gardening's had her as one of the top 10 blogs. She's been recognized for her gardening abilities by numerous people. But what inspires me about Kathy's blog is that she literally shows how you can grow a ton of food on like a tenth of an acre. And she works with, she not only works with growing low tunnels and season extension, but she's also works with showing school kids how to do gardens at the schools. So for me, Mother of a Hubbard, it's informative, it's entertaining, and it's a snapshot of real life in Appalachia.
Excellent. I'm going to have to look into that. Maybe we can get her for a guest on the show.
Oh, you would love it.
Cool. I'm all about the schools and growing food at the schools. And what a great idea to point out to them that it doesn't have to take a lot of room. Because I just think, you know, the schools use so many potatoes, even if we just got them growing their own potatoes. At least the schools that I've worked in, you know, there's potatoes all the time.
All the time.
I just think,
yes, ma'am.
We could get them, you know, eating organic homegrown, you know, that the kids are growing. The thing I have not figured out about the schools is that, you know, gardens need to work in the summer. Schools are closed in the summer. Haven't figured that piece out yet, but
a lot of schools are gone to the summer feeding program. So that's something that we're looking at here in Appalachia for our farmers is, you know, an outlet because summer we've got the produce, and if they're doing these summer feeds, you know, that's an opportunity. And I believe that's a national program, not just something regional. I think that's a national, I don't know whether it's through what government agency, but summer feeding. So I think that's a real opportunity for a lot of farmers throughout the United States, not just here in Appalachia.
Mm-hmm. That is a good point. And they do, the last school that I worked in, they did have the school open at lunch every day for the family. Anybody could go and get lunch at the one. It was a big district. Yeah. All right. Good point. But I'm thinking about the kids actually doing the work and growing the food is what I'm kind of thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
The kids getting
okay.
more involved.
Sure.
But that is a good thing to think about too. Okay. How about a favorite reading material? Like a book or a magazine or anything?
Uh-huh. I'm in love. And if he, I hope he hears this. He's in Canada. I don't know how far from Canada Montana is, but he's in Canada. I'm in love with John Martin Fortier. John Martin did a tour here in Kentucky. Well, he did a tour throughout the United States. It was called the Six Figure Gardening Tour, and I got to hear him in Kentucky. He spoke literally for about 5 hours straight with a little bit of a lunch break. His book is called The Market Gardener. It talks about how to make a good living using sustainable French bio-intensive farm methods. He grows about 2.5 acres in Canada, which is a much shorter growing season than what we have here in Kentucky. His method shows that you really can make good money on 2.5 acres. And in Appalachia, that's a real game changer because we don't have a lot of flat land, and 2.5 acres and a six-figure income is very attractive. You know, that's a very attractive proposition. It's something that Friends Drift In is aspiring to show that it can be done because there's a lot of naysayers that say it can't be done in Kentucky. And it may take me a couple years to figure it out, but I believe it can be done, and I believe it's a game changer. So John Martin Fortier and the Master Gardener.
Now, do you know where in Canada he is? Because like where I am, we're just 7 miles from the border, but that doesn't mean that...
I believe he's in
It's
Quebec.
A big place. Oh,
he's
yep.
in Quebec.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that might make a difference. So then does he must talk about marketing it too, huh?
he tells you, his philosophy is he grows for 100 shares of a community-supported agriculture, and then he does a little bit of restaurant work, but mostly it's a community-supported agriculture. He tells you, this is your raised bed at 100 feet. This is how many plants you need to put in that 100 feet. This is how many beds you need to do to supply 100 shares. You know, it breaks it down. This is when you need to start it. This is when, you know, this is what we're charging. This is how we're putting our baskets together. It is the most comprehensive and easily understood market farming book I have ever picked up. And trust me, if you saw the floor in my library, you would know that I've got every market, you know, I've got every gardening book known to man. And right. That one is the one that I keep close to my heart.
All right. Well, I can see I'm headed to Amazon as soon as we hang up. So, because that's great. And 100 shares, that wouldn't be that hard even where we are.
Right. Doable. And he shows how, I mean, you know, a six figure. Now, you think about that. Six figures on, you know, and their growing season is maybe 20 weeks. Where here in Kentucky, we've got almost 30. So, I mean, you know, I think it's doable. I think it's very doable.
I could live on a lot less than that.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. So you do have a business. So how about some advice for listeners? I mean, you did just tell us a lot, but like some of your tips about how to sell extra produce or get started in the industry. Like, how did you get your very first, like, tell us about your first farmer's market maybe, or whatever you want to share.
Well, one, I'm a personality. So, I mean, when I go to the farmer's market, I wear a big red hat. Everybody sees me coming. Everybody knows it's Joyce. I'm also very vocal on, you know, I make the circuit on the radio and TV. I'm considered the local expert on farming. But from a, you know, some people are just not cut out to do that type of work. But everybody that is a market gardener, if they are not sampling, if they are not doing samples at the market, and, you know, you got to know what your local food regulations are and get your, you know, whatever hoops you got to jump through for the government. But if you are not sampling at the market, you are missing sales.
Now, wait, explain us what that means. You mean like giving out samples, sharing samples?
Yes, ma'am. For me, I grow an Italian heirloom zucchini, summer squash. I have a little burner that sits on top of my table. I've got a skillet, olive oil. I slice up that summer squash. I saute it with that olive oil, a little sprinkle of garlic salt, and I serve it out. You know, I serve it to my clients. So where my competitors in the next booth can't give away zucchini 2 for $1, I'm selling Italian heirloom zucchini for $3 a piece. And it's all about because you sample it, you taste it, you see that there's a difference, you understand how quickly it can be prepared, you know, so you know, it's not this big major culinary production, you know, this isn't the Food Network, this is real life. So, you know, you chop it, you saute it, you throw a little spices on it, and you eat it. And, I mean, you know, that's how you sell a vegetable, is engaging all the senses. So find out what your rules are for sampling in your state. I mean, in Kentucky, you have to take a 2-hour class. It's not a big deal. I mean, it's a very simple class, basically about hygiene and keeping bugs off and keeping things covered and keeping things at the proper temperature. It's not that big of a deal, but it will make a huge difference. I would say it would make, I think they said at the Kentucky Fruit and Vegetable Conference last year, that by adding samples, you're going to increase your sales by 40%. And that's huge.
Wow. See, this is why this show, I think, is doing so well. Because when I have guests like you on who are sharing, I mean, that is just an incredible piece of knowledge, just a great way to get people excited to start, get people, you know, I can feel people's brains churning and different ideas and thinking and, you know, really tying in the whole cooking piece has been just really nice today to hear. So thank you so much for sharing that. All right. Ready for my final question?
Okay.
If there was one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either in your local area or on like a national or global scale?
Well, when I talk about Appalachia, I think about the mountains, and I call it my cradle. A lot of people, when they think of Appalachia and the coal fields, they think, oh, you know, they've got the mountains as a barrier. You know, it keeps the outside world at bay. I think of it, the mountains, as a cradle. And one of the great things about Appalachia is that because we have this cradle, we don't have the contamination of a lot of other agriculture pollen, like a GMO type pollen or agriculture pesticides coming in, because we're not that big of an agriculture community. So we're kind of this oasis, and we are the most biodiverse place on the planet by the authorities like National Geographic. You know, that's what they proclaim about us. And we have this really rich agriculture history. So for me, saving agriculture, saving the traditional Appalachian seeds, the beans, the corn, the very special Kushaws, that's a big deal for me, for, you know, changing the way that people think about Appalachia. Instead of thinking of it as a excess baggage and something that's dragging us down and desolate people that are not educated, you know, we have a lot going on here, and we have a very proud history. And we just don't tell our stories because we're very humble, and we just kind of keep our head down and do what we do. But for me, that would be the big thing, would be saving more seeds and preserving that diversity. As far as nonprofits, Grow Appalachia is here in Appalachia, and their goal is to help folks learn to garden again, to reintroduce them to the field, because we're about one generation removed from where people were really doing agriculture. And Grow Appalachia's goal is to not only start them with a family garden, but the idea is long-term and to bring them into market production. And I just think that is such an exciting thing in a post-coal economy. And then the second organization that I just absolutely love is an international organization called Heifer International. Mm-hmm. And they're one of the most trusted organizations ever. And how can you not love, if you're going to spend money on charity, how can you not love sending money to a farmer to help them produce their own food? How can you not do that? So for me, mm-hmm. those are the two little things. Those are the things that inspire me and move me along.
Mm-hmm. One of the first schools I taught in, the librarian, we all collected money for Heifer International. And I taught the kid, we made little piggy banks out of paper mache to save money for. That was a fun little, I was like, let's, because I love to do paper mache. So that was our student council project, was the kids all made a paper mache pig to save. And I think we, you know, I can't remember, it's been 10 years now. I can't remember if we bought chickens for someone or goats for someone, but yeah, I love Heifer International. It's a great organization.
Yes, ma'am.
Because it's empowering too. You're not just giving a gift, and you're
right.
Supporting women in the community and helping them not only be able to feed their families. You know, so many people in the United States don't appreciate the fact that we have guaranteed education for all of our boys and girls. I just sometimes I get so frustrated. I'm like, do you realize what a privilege this is, that other countries, not only do they have to pay for it, but the girls, you know, they have to, you know, collect firewood or water, or, you know, they can't afford to send the kids to school, and there's just so many things. And so I think Heifer International, you know, really empowers women and works to change that with you know, a sustainable and helping them help themselves. It's not just giving them money.
Right.
So I love that. All right. Just the last thing is, do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden? Like you couldn't, or like you haven't already, almost every question anyway. But
I think, you know, I've been a business person. I've been in the corporate world. You know, I joke about trading in my high heels for garden boots. And I think the most important thing for anyone is to find peace in their little corner of the world. And I think one of the ways to do that is to get in the garden and turn off the cell phone, connect to the cycles of life, reconnect to your dreams. Part of the solution, not the problem.
I like that, except I'm not turning my cell phone off in the garden.
Oh, work with me here, Jackie. Work with me.
No way. My cell phone's how I connect with people. Because look, I've met you through probably my cell phone. I mean, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm a mobile girl. So, but you know, when I take pictures in the garden, I don't know. But I love it. Thank you so much, Joyce. Do you want to tell listeners how to connect with you?
I'm on Facebook, Friends Drift In Kitchen. I'm also on Friends Drift In Farm Produce. I have a blog that I have neglected horribly, but it is friendsdriftin.com. That is N with I-N-N, like Friends Drift In, a restaurant. If you catch me on Facebook, I'm always got something going on.
Okay. I think that is where we met, on Facebook. Okay. And I will put the links to all of this in the show notes. So just thank you for going to town so we could make this phone call today. I know you had to go in. I hated to ask you to go in. And I don't know if today's your home day or you were, I don't know how it works, but thank you.
It's all good. It's all good. And we have phones in Appalachia, just in case anybody wants to stereotype us. It's just that I have a better connection here at the office. So. Okay.
Well, I know my cell phone doesn't actually work. Like, I'm always like, call me on my home phone, or, you know, I do the Skype interviews. But my electric company today came and they were like, we're going to shut your power off and it's only going to be for 5 seconds. I was like, don't you dare. Not right before my interview is going to start and turn off my internet connection. I don't care how long it is. I don't want to try to get that back up and running. So, and I did. It was like minutes. It was like, you know, they shut it off, but by the time I turned it on and played with the wires and got everything going, like, it was ticking down. So, well, thanks, Joyce.
Thank you, Jackie. Have a great day.
How would you like to win a copy of one of my all-time favorite gardening books, Rodale's An Ultimate Encyclopedia of Organic Gardening? If you enter our 2015 Gardening Challenge by going to our website at awesomemontana.com and clicking on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener Podcast, right on top, there's a link to the Gardening Challenge where you can fill out a simple form. It just asks your name, the number of people in your household, what vegetable, fruit, or flower you're choosing, how much you plan to grow, and where you live. You can always email me at organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com. There's no spaces, all lowercase, organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com. And just send me the information there too. Our goal is to help listeners be inspired to grow enough produce to feed your household for a year, or at least, you know, supplement your produce bill a little. So since our first challenge this year, we're just encouraging you to pick one fruit, a vegetable, or a flower, just one, that you would like to grow enough of for your household for 2 to 3 months, like for a season. Since it's a little late, we thought just, you know, 2 months. If you pick lettuce, you might, you know, it always depends. So something that you want to grow, 2 or 3 months worth, you know, kind of figure out how much would you buy if you went to the store. Would you buy a 2-pound bag of carrots every week, or would you buy, you know, a 10-pound bag of potatoes every couple of weeks? Or, you know, if you're picking flowers, you might think about, you know, a bouquet. You know, what do you want? Like enough carrots to feed you and your kids, or enough salad to have to eat every day for the month of July, or, you know, enough zinnias to have a fresh bouquet or two on your table each week? You know, whatever it is that you'd like to grow for a season, let us know and you'll be entered to win a copy of Rodale's Ultimate Encyclopedia of Gardening. And then I just want to encourage you, if there's anything we can do to help make your garden journey easier, more successful, if you have any questions, if you just want to share your challenges or successes, we would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback for the show, somebody, a guest you'd like to hear from, or a topic you want to learn more about, you know, please, you know, let me know. Any honest suggestions that we can implement are always appreciated. Just, let us know. Who are you? How do you like the show? What can we do? We'd love to hear from you. Again, you can always email me at organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com or just reach out to the contact form on the website. Thank you so much for listening to the Organic Garden Podcast today. Remember to